This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm one of your hosts for today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host, Paul Wearson. Hi, Paul.
We kind of missed you around here. You've been up in northern Wisconsin, northern. Up on Lake Superior, living the life of the Kennedys on the boat at Hyannis Point.
Not quite. And actually, I've been following the news from Ames, especially the weather. I had to come back to see if the Iowa flooding was worse than Wisconsin and Minnesota flooding. But it's amazing how fast the waters go down. It really, just driving on the highway, I wouldn't have realized how bad it's been. Roads were closed up in our area, and we experienced some pretty wild weather, heavy winds, which in a sailboat are always exciting, even if you're at the dock. But northern Minnesota was claiming 500-year floods. We only get 100-year floods. I can't imagine what that's like. But I didn't come back to do a weather report, in spite of the lovely morning we're having. But I've been inspired by the morning programming on KHOI to talk to you about some unusual things of a different character.
Well, I'm curious to know what you're thinking about. But we have the old radio veteran, Dennis Hart, here. And he's going to give us a preview of stories from the regional papers. Welcome, Dennis.
Well, thank you, Paul and Susan. I'm not that old, am I?
I'm saying old veteran. Oh, like old. A veteran, as an old, you know.
Oh, I see. I'll accept that as
a young
apology.
Veteran of the old story.
Good morning, everyone. We will start with the Nevada Journal, which reports that a Nevada teenager hopes to make it back home next month in time for his birthday after having surgery at University Hospitals in Iowa City. 13-year-old Jaden Robinson will undergo surgery July 9th to correct a malformation in his brain. His birthday is July 14th, and after both those things, a benefit's going to be held for Jaden's family to help pay the medical bills. That benefit's going to take place Friday, July 20th in Nevada. Also in the journal, a feature story about a hairstylist. That's right, a hairstylist who is celebrating her 50th year in business, 40 of them in Nevada. Vicki Tendell graduated from Nevada High in 1968. She says three iconic women and the distinctive hairstyles they wore set the tone for much of her career. So you're asking, who are those women? Olympic figure skater Dorothy Hamill, Charlie's Angels TV star Farrah Fawcett, and can you guess the last one? Friends TV star Jennifer Aniston. You can read much more about Vicki Tendell in the journal. In this week's Boone News Republican, word that Boone Mayor John Slight has asked the state auditor's office to conduct a financial audit of the Boone County Historical Society. That society has come under intense criticism for its handling of the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower birthplace closure last October, about its reluctance to disclose its financial status, and about how it's allegedly treated some of its members. The Historical Society has overseen the birthplace since 2006, when the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower Birthplace Foundation sold it for $1. In recent months, both the Boone City Council and the Boone County Board of Supervisors have pulled financial support from the Historical Society. Both entities have urged the Society to work with the Birthplace Foundation to reopen the Eisenhower Museum. The News Republican also reported that a recent citywide cleanup in Boone resulted in the collection and removal of 117 tons of junk and debris. A lot of tons there. The city council has approved plans for a dental clinic, which will be built on Lynn Street, and the Boone School District recently approved an agreement with the city of Boone regarding tennis courts. The city is resurfacing and repairing the courts, and the school district's going to pay half the cost in exchange for being able to use the courts for school tennis practices. The News Republican also reported on the Madrid City Council meeting when the council approved a paving project for East 6th Street. And there's word that during the month of May, Fairway corporate workers paid $5 on Fridays to wear jeans. They raised $600 doing that, and they're going to donate that money to the Sleeping Angels Foundation, whose mission is to help families who have suffered the loss of a child. In the Story City Herald, word that David Zeisnes has been chosen to take over as chief of the Gilbert Franklin Township Fire Department, effective July 8th. He will replace current chief Ben Smith, who is stepping down. The Herald also reports that the Colonesco School Board has approved new carpeting for the 5th and 6th grade classrooms, a new dishwasher and boiler for the Colo building, and new construction on concession stand bathrooms. The board also recently heard about a potential new security system that would print badges from visitors' identifications, badges that would be displayed while those visitors are on school sites. And the Herald has a list of upcoming events, including a fireworks show in Roland next Tuesday, July 3rd, at dusk. And on the 4th, Story City's Antique Carousel, going to celebrate Independence Day from noon until 4. There will be games and activities for the whole family. In the Tri-County Times, word of the upcoming reunion of graduates of Slater High School. Now, what makes that one especially noteworthy is that Slater High went out of existence 60 years ago, in 1958, when the school was consolidated into the Ballard School District. 157 invitations were sent out for this latest reunion, and 56 people say they will be there. Now, the earliest class represented in this reunion is 1934, and the person coming from that class is 101 years old. 101. Congratulations indeed to everyone involved. And that, Susan and Paul, your weekly summary of news from several newspapers. I'm Dennis Hart. Not quite 101 yet, I want to add. And I'm going to be back here live, I hope, on Friday, still alive, with news from the pages of the Ames Tribune.
Well, Dennis, it's great to have you here. It's just a pleasure to see you. And I have a special bond with Dennis because we're from the radio days prior to this century.
Yes, we are.
Tape to tape, reel to reel. Turntables and all that sort of thing.
Yes.
And actually, Dennis has a real inspiring hairdo, too, so looking back to the people. The woman who's got the big, long list of achievements in cosmetology.
I appreciate your appreciating my hairdo, and I just want to make it clear it's all mine.
Yeah, Dennis and I both have a full head of hair after all these years.
We do, okay.
I attribute it to fertilizer or something like that.
We used to call that something else in broadcasting, but we couldn't say it on the air. Thank you very much, Paul.
Still can't.
Dennis Hart with the news.
Take care, you guys.
Yeah, well, I what you really have is the live persona. And that is great. You know how to do it live. And that's why I teamed up with Paul in the first place. I thought, wow, I can't be that cool on the air. And now there are two of you.
Well, for just so those people may not know that during part of the year, I am not here in Iowa, and I record it and send it in, so there can't be a lot of interaction. It's a lot better to have the interaction. I enjoy this.
It also sounds a lot better. I mean, it's amazing. The live voice is really wonderful.
And I really look a lot better in person than on the phone, don't I?
Well, we both have a great face for radio.
We do indeed.
Yeah, okay, well, before we have a show here.
Oh, I didn't know that was going to happen.
It's one of the things that I've enjoyed while I was listening from afar online was that I heard Paul reminisce with his classmate, John Roney, on Heart of Iowa last week. Your discussion of the artesian well along Highway 69 reminded me of a wonderful historic interview from Kay Munson I got at the time the new Story City swimming pool was built. She was telling about the time when there were no swimming pools in small towns, and the big attraction in central Iowa was Lake Comar, which was built from artesian springs. This would have been in the 1920s and 30s. After that, local history, I found a couple of other stories that will take listeners to places they've never been, literally around the world and into the future. And
that's an interesting and intriguing prospect, but let's get started with Kay's story. She's a dear friend of mine, by the way, and as many listeners from Story City know, Kay Munson was a lifelong resident who just left the area after the death of her husband, Dick, earlier this year. She was a distinguished violinist who was still able to play violin at a family wedding when she was 95.
But her achievement at age 5 at Lake Comar was still a high point of her life when she told me this story. Let's begin by setting the scene for summertime.
There's a time in each year that we always hold dear, good old summertime, with the birds in the trees and sweet-scented breezes, good old summertime.
Could you talk just a little bit about the 20s and the 30s and what was happening then and why Lake Comar was important?
For one reason, there just were not lakes in central Iowa. So any size body of water was unusual. And so that attracted people, the fact that they could swim.
One thing that many of our listeners may not have vividly in their minds is what it was like in the summer in Iowa in the 20s and the 30s. You had no air conditioning. Probably most people didn't even have fans. Is that right?
Well, we didn't have a fan in our house, and it was very hot, and particularly in a few years in the mid-30s, it was over 100 degrees, I remember, one summer for 2 weeks. But we'd drive to Comar. It seemed like it was 10 degrees cooler. There were a lot of shade trees there, and then you could go swimming and cool off. The big activity at Comar was on Sundays when they had live entertainment. There was radio, but radio was just in its infancy in the 20s. Even in the late 20s and early 30s, a lot of people didn't have radios, or they had these small table ones. To have live entertainment was very special. And Fred Cornelissen scheduled the live entertainment, started in the winter, scheduling his groups. But he had wholesome entertainment. Any parent could feel free about their children going out and seeing the entertainment that was there. Usually every summer the Carl King Band would come from Fort Dodge. I remember there was a gymnastic group from Ames that came up because my sister was so interested in that. There would be players that would go from place to place that would present short plays. And then musical, special musical entertainment. There was a stage for the performers, but the rest of the area, for people to watch the entertainment, there were bleachers where they could sit, and they could sit on the ground. But we needed to have good weather for that Sunday in order to enjoy the entertainment, which was in the afternoon and in the evening. And if it was a rainy Sunday, then, of course, that reduced the crowds greatly. To be successful, they needed good Sundays to make the money because there was live entertainment, but there were also a place to buy ice cream and candy bars and hot dogs. Every other year, they had the 4th of July celebration out there. Amazingly, on Sundays, men were wearing suits and coats. Of course, if it was hot, they took their suit coat off, but they'd have on shirts. There was no casual jeans worn at that time. They just were dressed as they would have been dressed for church in the morning. During the depths of the Depression, we did with what we had and enjoyed what we had. But most people could pay that 25 cents for a car to go to Comar on Sunday. Now, there was no charge during the week. People could come in and have picnics and use the facilities, however they would pay to swim. But at any rate, they would be free to use the picnic grounds. So it was a great place for recreation at very low cost during a time when people had so little money.
What ended it?
I think that radio had an effect as it became more popular and people would listen to radio programs. They didn't feel the need for the live entertainment on Sundays. Having a summer with rain on Sundays, I'd say a third of the Sundays, that really takes out the profit. Fred found out that the water, this artesian well water, would be excellent for growing goldfish. So he was experimenting with that while he was continuing with the programs at Comar. And then he would raise special kinds, you know, there are many varieties, special kinds of goldfish. The water at Comar was the same temperature winter and summer, and it was rather unusual. So he was able to have small ponds to grow the goldfish using this artesian well water. So he had a truck, and he would go to, at that time, the dime stores where they were selling goldfish. And goldfish were popular. And so he would go to Kansas City, to Omaha, to Minneapolis, selling the goldfish. So that's how he made a living. People could still go there and swim, but at their own risk. And the golf course was open until World War II. Then it was plowed up for for crops. And that was really the end when the golf course was plowed up. And the best special thing was that there were four or five artesian wells on this farm. So it had been noted for some time for its artesian wells. And they gave forth a large volume of water. So then it was possible to dam up the water and make a lake. And they named it Lake Comar, taking the first two letters from Fred Corneliusen's name, C-O, and M-A-R from Marvik. Now, in a couple of years before 1920, Seward Marvik sold his interest to Fred Corneliusen, but they kept the name the same. The land was about 2.5 miles south of Story City. It was lined by trees. There were two lakes. One of them was the swimming lake, was about the size of 2.5 Olympic-sized pools. This is a large area for now as well as for then. And it was divided in half eventually. It wasn't very deep. I suppose the water wasn't over 5 or 6 feet deep. And so they weren't able to dive. And they excavated half the size of the swimming pool to make it deep enough so there could be diving boards and that activity. And then they put a cement on the bottom of that half. And then there was a division of just old logs that were put down in the middle. So the sand bottom that was shallow was on one side, and then the diving area on another. And it was separated by this remarkable, very high tower. And at the top of the tower, there was even a diving board. And so many people would just go up there and jump off. But when I was 5, I was bribed with 50 cents to dive off that high tower. And I did it. You know, even when you're little, I was 5 years old when that happened. And even when you're that age, you sense, on Sundays, people would crowd around the pool to watch people swimming. This was unusual to see people swim. And I could tell and sense that people were waiting to see me dive because I was a little girl, and little girls didn't even swim in those days, or not many.
Well, in case you've just tuned in, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. This is Paul Wearson, one of your hosts for today, together with my co-host, Susan Franson, and we've just heard an archived recording of Kay Munson telling us about long-ago summers in Central Iowa at the artesian spring-fed lake, Lake Comar.
It's a big jump from Kay's story to our next interview with Patience Lemoine. I'm just going to let her say it. I have practiced it from Patience. This is a continuation of the series of interviews with present Central Iowa residents from African countries. I learned about Patience from her husband, Paul Luth, who came to Ames in 1982. He came from Ames in 1982 from South Sudan, just as the war for its independence from Sudan was starting. Patience has a very different story, which started in the Uganda of a brutal dictator Idi Amin and continued to three other African countries. Her personal story did, not the dictator, showing the contrast of life among those countries.
Well, now, Idi Amin, isn't that the dictator portrayed by Forrest Whitaker in that film, The Last King of Scotland? The movie won the 2006 Academy Award for Best Actor for him.
Yes, that's it. And I hope some of our listeners have seen that movie. But for those who haven't, it's a portrait of a terrifying time in Uganda history. And Patience will refer to that in the story she will tell us.
My name is Patience Lamunu Opio Lueth, and I am originally from Uganda. So Idi Amin's reign caused kind of a shift, I would say, in what leadership looked like in Uganda. Prior to that, of course, it was a British colony. So, and independence came. The country was given back to Uganda, and then his dictatorship came, which meant that just everything was like just turned around. For example, we had many nationalities in Uganda. And I don't know what years these were, but when he came into power, he gave the Indians, from what I was told, the stories I was told and what I've read, he gave them 3 days to leave. So these are Indians who, and I'm talking about Indians from Asia, Indians who have lived there, were born there. Right. He said, get out of the country. And a lot of the Indians were business people. They were good for the economy. So they had to leave. Just the economy pretty much went downhill, you know, after that. I'm not saying just because of the Indians, but it's because of the dictatorship. Uganda used to be called the Pearl of Africa. My dad used to tell me about when he went to medical school and in Makerere University, one of the best universities in the world. He said that people from Britain would come to medical school there to learn. That's how good of a school it was. And he'd talk about the food that they would serve. And they were, like, treated very, very well, you know. But then after that, you know, again, the Pearl of Africa pretty much, I would say, died, right? It became, it was trampled on. And so that set the stage for leadership, you know, that were greedy. Even after Idi Amin was kicked out, another president came to power. That particular president was kicked out. And he was kicked out mainly because of who he was, of his ethnic, I would say his tribe, right? I'm from the Acholi tribe, a very persecuted people. Even just recently, the recent, like 20 years or so, like with the Lord Resistant Army, persecution happened. Idi Amin himself persecuted who I'd call my people, the Acholi people, from the northern part of Uganda. A lot of them scattered. So a lot of the Acholi are all over the world, all over the globe. And we always find community. So not only Acholi, but the Ugandans always find community in different parts of the world. But at the same time, there's always that longing. You know, my dad always longed to see Uganda come together and be free of dictatorship and be free, you know, just to be the country they once were. These are stories I've heard from my dad because he was on Idi Amin's hit list. He was a practicing doctor in Uganda at the time. And one of the ministers, Idi Amin ministers, his wife came to give birth at the hospital. And the minister himself said, well, you take care of my wife. And my dad says, I'm doing my rounds right now. I cannot do that, but a nurse will come and be right with you. And this upset the minister, one of Idi Amin's ministers. And that's how he got on the hit list. Eventually, like, he found out every time spies, or I would even call them assassins, but spies came to look for my dad. He wasn't there, thankfully. And so he ended up finding out that there were people looking to take his life in connection with that event of the birth. And he escaped. So he left with a briefcase. My mom was left. She stayed in Uganda for about 3 months. Around that time, you know, people were killed. My uncles, you know, we had family in politics as well, also on my mom's side as well. So she had to figure out a way to leave. She actually hired a truck driver, and kind of packed everything in the truck, a very big truck, all our property, and left the house. She was also in hiding because, you know, if they're coming for one of you, pretty much they're coming for all of you. And so she ended up at the border. So she was in the truck until they got close to the border. And she had my older sister and my older brother with her. And I've forgotten how old they were. It must have been like maybe 4 and 3 because they're really close in age. And I was in her belly, you know, so she pretty much jumped the border from Uganda to Kenya. She had told the guy, you know, of course, given him some extra money to say that he was delivering stuff for this rich family. And so she had to, you know, she had to pay him to do that. But she crossed the border and met my dad. I don't know exactly where they met. I still have to ask her. But I ended up being born in Kaimosi, Kenya, which is in the southwest of Kenya. And my dad was a medical doctor there as well. So I was born. And then within about a year, we left to go to Northern Ireland.
To Northern Ireland?
Mm-hmm.
Why did you go there?
We went there as refugees. And you know, I'm pretty sure my mom had told me that, you know, their lives were still in danger, even in Kenya. And so we had to go somewhere where my dad felt safe. So he actually went to school to become an orthopedic surgeon in Northern Ireland. So we were the first black family in that area. Yeah, I remember when my younger brother was born, you know, my mom would tell me the nurses were so surprised. I mean, they called everybody to come see this black baby because they'd never seen a black baby being born.
Incidentally, I believe that Northern Ireland was a rather violent place at the time you were there also.
Yes, I didn't feel the violence. I really didn't. I felt the racism for sure. But not, you know, the Catholic Protestant wars, I didn't feel that. We were Anglican, and I'm not sure if we just lived on the Anglican side of town. I have no idea. But I know that there was racism for sure.
How was that manifest?
Well, as kids, we'd play outside, right? And we'd get teased almost every day by skinheads. And I only knew that there were skinheads later. Right. As a young child, you just don't know. But I know they had shaven heads, and every day they'd call us names and they'd throw eggs at our window. And one day my mom got tired of it. So we came in crying for the last time. And she just takes off like running after them, and she catches one. She grabs him. It looked quite cartoonish. Grabs him by the collar and asks him, where do you live? And he doesn't want to say anything, and he's crying by now, right? And my mom's like, well, you're coming to live with us then. And so she starts taking him home. And he's like, okay, I live over there. So she takes him to his house, you know, and knocks at the door. Because we were behind her the whole time. And I remember, like, a gate. And then having the gate having to open and then going in. And her knocking at the door. And the mom answering the door. The mom was like, no, let's wait for the dad. And well, then he's coming home to live with me. Right. And so she begins to pull him away. She's like, okay. And ever since then, after that, the whole neighborhood was very nice to us. Never again did we experience that teasing that we did. Although in school, I have, you know, I think my brother and my sister, my older brother and sister got teased at school. But there was one other boy, we called him a cousin, but he was just a family friend. And I believe they were from Ghana. And one day they were being teased, and this boy, you know, he's a little bit older, the one we called cousin, and he grabbed this guy and put his face in the ground, right? So it's almost like you had to stand up for each other, you know, and if you didn't stand up, you'd continue to be. So, yeah, so that's how it kind of manifested.
Then you left Northern Ireland, mm-hmm. and went to
Zambia. So my dad worked at the teaching hospital in Zambia for a long time on Jacaranda Road. Paul and I, in 2012, went to Zambia on missions, and we were able to visit the house my family used to live in. My mom drove up from Botswana. It's a long drive. And we met in Lusaka and we visited the house. The woman was really, the only woman who lived there. You know, the difference is that we had a chain link fence, but, you know, very short chain link fence. And now there's like tall walls, right? Security, of course, they've upped the security because it's a little more, you know, dangerous or less safe, I'd say, rather than dangerous. And so we knocked at that gate and the person's like, what are you doing here? And we had to explain to her, we used to live here, you know, and of course she didn't trust us. You know, maybe we wanted to steal something, but she eventually let us in because we were able to describe what was there. Right. So I remember the courtyard with the large lemon tree. And then there was the backyard with the mulberry. Yeah. So mulberry, it's not like mulberry bush. It was a tree taller than the telephone, the, you know, wires.
Yes.
And we used to climb there. I got stung by a wasp there. So, you know, we're telling her all this stuff. And back there is, you know, what happened to that gate in the back? You know, so we're telling her and describing to her the house. And that's how she believed us, that we actually lived there. And she didn't let us in, you know, she didn't, because I really wanted to see that courtyard, that where my dad used to sit and peel sugar canes, you know, with his teeth. And there were four of us, so he'd divide it into quarters, that section or that segment, and give it to us. We just sit out there just chewing sugar cane and spitting it. You know, you spit out the the fibers. So, yeah, so we lived in Zambia until January 1989 when we moved to Botswana.
And how old were you when you moved to Botswana?
11, yes.
And you had quite a lot of your education there then before you came to the United States.
Yes, yes. From grade 7 all the way to what we'd call Form 5, which is grade 12 here. And then I went to University of Botswana, for 1.5 years. I studied biology and physics before I came here to study architecture.
But one of the ways many, many Americans know Botswana is because of Mara Motswe and the number one ladies detective agency, mm-hmm. which is a very appealing picture mm-hmm. of Botswana.
Yeah.
You can feel the love the author has for Botswana, and he must have known some prototypes for those characters.
Yeah, and, you know, I have not read a full book yet, but from even the Botswana who have read the books say it's a very accurate picture of what, you know, so when he paints a picture of the place or of the people, it's quite accurate. So I should go. I actually have one at home. I should read it this summer just to really see, you know, whether it's true or not. Right now, Botswana has the best economy in Africa. Of course, it thrives off of diamonds and cows, right? So the population of cows is greater than the population of people. There's very few people with a lot of land. And so, again, it's just a very peaceful country, very reasonable in terms of politics. Good legal system. Also, they take care of their citizens, right? So, I mean, if you're a citizen there, they will put you first. I mean, they really take care of you. Yeah, it's a very attractive place to be. So when my dad went there, he was the only orthopedic surgeon in the whole country. And so when people needed an orthopedic surgeon, they would come to him.
Did you live in the capital?
We didn't live in the capital when we first went there. We were in Francistown, which is close to Zimbabwe. It's close to the Zimbabwean border. And then we moved to Gaborone, which is the capital, and went back and forth, right? So at some point, my mom was a businesswoman. She had a school. She sold all sorts of things. Even in Zambia, she sold it. I remember her selling shoes and popcorn. She was a teacher, but she did all sorts of things. She bought a knitting machine once and knitted. We knitted sweaters for the school district. And I remember us helping her stitch the sleeves to the body of the sweaters. Anyway, so she was a businesswoman, so she'd travel back and forth, and we'd go to Francistown and then Gaborone. So at some point, it's like we would only see one of our parents at a time because we were back and forth. We ended up in Gaborone. That's where my mom is right now, and my dad is buried there as well. They became citizens of Botswana.
And then you came to Ames. You came, though, as a university student.
Yes, I came as an international student on an F-1 visa. And I wanted to study architecture. I just remember as a little kid liking to draw, although I drew fashion, you know, more clothes. And my dad kept a painting, and it was, I don't know if it's still hanging in the house. It might be a painting I did when I was in the eighth grade. So he kept that painting as a perspective of a house, of these rows of houses, which is very interesting because when I came here to America, those houses, you know, kind of the cookie cutter houses, right, as they kept coming up, popping up in Ames, it's very reminiscent of that, of that painting. So I used to like to draw that sort of stuff. And so when I came here, I studied architecture. And I was here for a while. I remember someone telling me architecture is a hard program to get into. I don't know about this. You know, like they were kind of discouraging me from trying to go into it. And, you know, I'm a little strong-willed. So I said, well, I'll show you that I can get into architecture. And, of course, I got in and graduated. So,
and what do you do in the architecture department?
Okay, so my home department is the architecture department. I focus on teaching first and second year students design foundations. So in the architecture department, I teach the second year studio, which is called Architecture 201, and that's their first year in the program. Because there's that 1 year period where you have to get that core, that foundation in, and then you apply using a portfolio, and they look at GPA as well and so on. So I teach in the architecture department. I also teach in the interdisciplinary design department. I teach a class called Design Thinking, and I also teach in the Design Studies program, which is kind of at the core level, which is the whole College of Design. So we feed the different departments their students. And I also coordinate Design Studies 102, which is one of the studios that they have to take before they apply into their programs.
Now that you have lived here all these years, do you really feel at home?
I feel comfortable. I don't know if that's necessarily a feeling of home. So when I say I'm going home, if I'm talking to random people, I say I'm going home, it means I'm going to Botswana.
So Botswana feels like home.
Yes.
That's where your mother is.
Yes. Botswana feels like home. And I don't know if it's because that's where my mother is and that's where my dad is buried. But I think it's because it feels like home here only because of Paul and family, you know, the kids. I think I understand my parents a little more because their heart was always in Uganda. And so, and my heart is there too, you know, so I hurt when it feels like politics is unfair in Uganda or when people are killed or, you know, so my heart is also in Uganda. It's not in Kenya though, although I could get citizenship in Kenya if I wanted, but it's not, you know, so Botswana and Uganda is where my heart lies.
This is KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM, and you just heard Patient Lueth describing family experiences in Uganda, Kenya, Zambia, Botswana, and Northern Ireland. She has lived in Ames for 23 years, but the tour of these countries that she just told about shows how our lives in central Iowa are linked to events around the world.
Well, now, Susan, you've certainly come up with some very unusual interviews, but what's coming next sounds like one of the best. You went to a meeting a couple of weeks ago called Wild Iowa Discovery. Now, what was that about?
Some of our listeners heard a preview of that about a month ago when Nature reporter Pat Schlarbaum talked with Mark Edwards, one of the organizers. The most powerful idea of that discussion for me was the realization that Iowa is the most altered landscape in the country, with only a tiny percentage not under cultivation or pavement or even altered to become parks. But that wasn't really what people were talking about. I was able to listen in on some of the conversations, and I found it very thought-provoking, but challenging to summarize. Mark has agreed to come back to fill us in on what was actually happening at the gathering. Thanks for coming over from Boone today, Mark. Sure. I know that Paul will have some questions for you, too. Do you have a brief quote or a remark to get us started?
Well, I started with Thoreau, actually, way back in college, and that's kind of been my path ever since. And I was always appreciative of his quote, "In wildness is the preservation of the world." And I struggled with what that meant for, how old am I? Over 70 now. So it's been a while. And most people see that quote and they see in wilderness is the preservation of the world. And so that starts the conversation right there. And your previous interview with that woman I thought was really fascinating because she was talking about home. And when we think of wilderness, we don't think of being at home in the wilderness, but we can be at home in the wildness. And so that kind of really gets us into what do those words mean? How do we apply those to our life? And, you know, it's important how we relate to where we are. And I think that's a good way to start. So in wildness is the preservation of the world. What does that mean? And that was a lot of our discussion at that meeting, and it's a good discussion.
Well, Mark, I really enjoy that terminology because wilderness is ultimately our home. We all spring from a wild place, you know, the tribal That's cultures right. and all the things where humanity evolved from. And we've lost touch with a lot of that. But an interesting perspective is when you grow up in the 50s like I did, it seems looking back that we thought all resources were unlimited.
Yeah.
It's only in recent years we've seen sort of a realization that things are more finite than we thought.
That's interesting. You know, that's from a European cultural perspective, because actually, for I would say, for most of human history, that wasn't the world view. They didn't look at their land in separation of wildness and everything. You know, the Europeans would think that they're living in wilderness, and to them, it's home. You know, it's not wilderness; it's home. This is their provides their needs.
No, I really think that. Well, I was just saying earlier, my roommate in college was taking a course in ecology, and I had never heard that word. We're talking about 1964.
Wow.
That's my first contact with ecology.
Right.
How would you define ecology, Mark?
Well, that's a good one. I used to do a lot of public presentations, and I would begin with the most important scientific discovery of the 20th century was ecology. And ecology is the understanding of the world that you live in. And so the basic tenet of ecology is the more diversity, the healthier the ecosystem. The healthier the ecosystem, the healthier the individual. So it's explaining that everything's kind of tied together and your needs are met from the world that you live in. And so what is that relationship between you and the world that you live in?
I think one of the things that was a real page-turner for people out there realizing where we are in terms of our planet is when the astronauts first went to the moon, even the first flights where they just orbited and came home. For the first time, you saw the entire Earth
right
in a photo frame. And around the Earth was this little ribbon
yeah
of atmosphere. Right. First, you see the Earth is so isolated. And then you see this little ribbon of lighter blue that holds us in and is a finite system. And you realize we're drinking the same water Jesus drank.
Yeah.
You know, it's a closed yeah system. And I think that was important for the average person to see where we are out there in the universe.
Right.
And how this little package sustains us.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think that's the climate discussion we're having now when you talk about that side. And then here in Iowa, we're talking about the other ribbon of a few inches of soil. Our whole future is dependent on that few inches of soil.
And will you tell people over time how much of this soil has been lost?
Oh, boy.
Do you have those numbers? What kind of?
Well,
like
we used to say.
We went from 1860 to now.
Right. We used to say it was we'd lost half the topsoil between 16 and 18 inches in 100 years. And I think the last thing coming out of Iowa State was we've lost half of the topsoil left in 50 years. So we're talking about, you know, that's why we're getting into no-till, planting cover crops, those kinds of things, because we're realizing that loss of soil is going really fast.
Well, when I look out there, I was raised on a farm. And every fall, we did the four-bottom plow, and we huge dirt clods.
Yeah.
We went very deep in there. And then in the wintertime, you'd see the ditches blackened. The snow would be blackened by all the wind erosion
mm-hmm
from all that deep soil that had been turned over. And now you see a lot less disturbance. But
right
when I look around me here in central Iowa, I don't see a lot of cover crops or no-till.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very slow to be adopted technology when you leave it to volunteering to participate.
Right. Well, I do a lot of paddling, and so I see these sandbars and all this silt coming in, and I think, you know, you have to understand that soil's really always moving. It's the mountains are always moving to the sea. You know, that's an ongoing thing, and that's the law of gravity, right? So all that soil keeps coming off. They're even saying you have soil erosion on flat 0% slope. So imagine that. You're still getting soil erosion there because we're taking the produce of that soil off and not replenishing it with anything. So that's the soil still leaving it all that time. It's just imperceptible to us.
And then
to
we
see
have to get in touch with the fact that it took eons of time to build up that soil.
That's right.
And so, you know, if that's a crisis, if you're using a finite resource like that.
Yeah, they talk about 600 to 1,000 years to make an inch of soil, and yeah you can see that disappear in some of these heavy rains lately.
Well, people have to possess the gift of looking way beyond their own existence to future generations and the welfare of the planet when they're gone, when their great-grandchildren or great-great-grandchildren are trying to live in a vastly altered environment if we don't do anything about it.
That's right. And I think that gets back to the throw in wildness is the preservation of the world.
Well, I'd like to get to something that I picked up from the discussion at this gathering, because you had people who were talking about watersheds and corridors.
Good.
And, you know, connectivity corridors. We talk about that for the butterflies, so that the butterflies can have places where they can find the milkweed as they go along to reproduce.
Right.
And that, of course, is where the disturbed landscape in Iowa is so significant. But it's not just the land. It's the water. And they were talking about the watershed, the Mississippi watershed. And this really clicked for me because I've been hearing on KHOI a lot about watersheds because we have currently educational projects for people to become aware of their watershed where they live, like the Kigley Branch watershed.
Right.
And but to think about the Mississippi watershed, and I remember somebody saying people in South Carolina don't think about themselves as being in a Mississippi watershed. People in, is it North Dakota?
Montana. Up into Canada, actually, is still
The Mississippi watershed. And, of course, one of the principles of the watershed is what goes in up here goes out down here, and that's the dead zone in the Gulf.
Yes.
And a lot of that comes from Iowa.
Right. Well, I think that's the context that we're trying to explore in our thing. We tried to look at the Iowa as the most biologically altered state in North America. So what does that mean? That means that two-thirds of the state only has two species on it, corn and soybeans. It means that 87% of the state has been tilled. It means up to about 92% of the state has been given to agricultural use, if you include pasture and all those kinds of other things like that, hay fields. And then you get into what's really left, you know, is the water courses in Iowa. So the watershed has now become extremely important. And my job in the DNR back was to establish the Water Trails program because we were trying to get people to be out and identify with those water sources so that they could – that was the last place you could really go. We have very little public land in Iowa. So if you look, kayaks are now selling way faster than ATVs because people are now moving into that source because it's the only public access land out there to get on. And so as they get out on that water, we're hoping that, you know, they more identify with what's going on with that water. So for me, those water courses are the corridors that are left in Iowa to work with and to help wildlife move across the landscape. And so I like to talk about our water quality has become such a scary thing. The lesser scob duck, the most common diving duck in North America, cannot fly across the state of Iowa without losing so much body weight. It either can't reproduce or it starves to death. And their numbers are going down pretty quick. So, you know, we have to start understanding what's going on in that water. If they can't find something to eat in that water, and I go out and paddle lots, okay, and I haven't seen a turtle on the Boone River in years, okay? Now, I can go to other rivers, Missouri, and I can count 20 turtles per mile. But here, I can't find a turtle, and I'm looking for turtles, okay? So I think, you know, at some point, we've got to start looking at how those corridors are so important. And you mentioned the 31 states. So we focused on Iowa, and we said if we're ground zero and we need to get our stuff together here, then we're part of a larger watershed of these other 31 states like Canada and Montana and South Carolina. And that's the part we need to look at developing these corridors so that these species can move across the landscape. And when you've devoted, you know, 90-something percent of your landscape to agricultural use, lots of species can't make it across that landscape. So we're like the interstate system between Minnesota, which has a lot still left, and Missouri, which has a lot left. So how are things going to move along, especially if you're thinking of climate change and what the effects that's going to be? And so we don't even know what that's all going to happen. But we know already that species are trying to move north. So we know the temperature is changing no matter what the cause. So how are they going to be able to do that? So I look across the United States. I think in 1950s, France started building overpasses on their roads so that other species could get across the highway. And so now, like if you take Banff, say the large national park in Canada, I think they have 53 structures or something now, allowing other creatures to get across just the interstate system. And you'll see pictures of all kinds of different, you know, bears and deer and everything at the same time going over these overpasses.
Well, it would be nice if we could get some of the deer, if we had a few more deer going over overpasses instead of right in front of our cars.
There's been a study done, and actually they said it would, what insurance pays out in terms of vehicle damage and damages and people and all that, that you could afford to build the overpasses cheaper than pay that insurance. So think about that. I mean, we're going to have to start thinking about that.
I remember Ashton Kutcher, the Iowa-born actor. He was a guest on Jay Leno's show, and he said, "Everybody in Iowa has hit a deer, Jay."
Yeah, I'm afraid I have two. One inside of Ames City Limits and one inside of Boone City Limits.
Yeah, when I was young, if you played games like allowing points for spotting wildlife, deer was high because you hardly ever saw a deer.
Exactly. That
in the 50s.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
And my first awareness is Rachel Carson's Silent Spring.
Yeah.
When we realized that DDT was harming the reproductive cycle of eagles and a lot of other species.
That's
too.
Right. Yeah.
That was the first time I remember anyone thought of putting brakes on chemicals and things that were distributed in the environment.
Yeah.
That was a landmark case.
I just read a quote by her the other day that I just loved. In fact, I wrote it down. I brought it with me because I loved it so much. They're questioning her. The chemical companies are questioning her authority to be able to speak about how bad these chemicals are. And she says, well, that's like trying to ignore the law of gravity. You can deny it all you want, but I'm sorry.
Well, of course, in the DNR's response, I think it's the DNR that's cut the funding for water testing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, on the Boone River where I paddle a lot, they've just taken that out, the nitrogen. And then, you know, that affects our drinking water in Boone. So we've had where we couldn't drink our water because the nitrogen was so high. And so, yeah, why were we quitting testing? Well, everywhere that we test is putting more places onto the impaired water list, you know, that's going to need attention. So testing is scaring us.
The real issue is public backing. To what extent will the public become aware? And I know that's part of your calling.
That's right.
To make sure that the public knows what the haps are, we used to say in the 60s. What are the haps, man? We have to find out what the haps are.
Yeah.
And when you look at public awareness, like the last week here, we've had a lot of flooding in Iowa. Suddenly, people are thinking about watersheds.
That's right.
Because it impacts them in the real time, you know.
That's right.
And when the weather guy says, I remember the other day they superimposed the watershed map over their radar map. Because they were showing the watersheds and how these sudden rainfalls are likely to behave when they're accumulating in these watersheds. Now people care about that because it's my basement at stake.
You bet. Well, we need that direct approach.
Yeah.
I mean, we need that direct understanding. That's important.
But it's hard to understand. The hard thing, in this case, we're talking about an emergency. What happens to my basement, my street? It's hard to get people aware when they're not facing an emergency nearby. The awareness of the long term and the responsibility to the future and things that aren't directly in your experience this week. But the only thing that comes positively out of a flood for me is people's increased awareness of what happens with water.
That's right.
That's right. They realize that all these things are tied together, and what happens up north impacts the south. It becomes easier to visualize the dead zone then.
Absolutely. You know, absolutely.
Because all this terminates in the Gulf.
Right. Yeah. We're all tied together. I mean, that's ecology.
That's ecology. And that, I think you guys, and me too, could go on talking about this for a long time, but we're going to have to do that at the end, because the end of the hour has come.
Yes, and Mark, thank you. It's been delightful to have you here, and I'm sure you'll be back.
Yeah. Thank you.
Listen to today's talk show and any of our past local talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. And now that's khoifm.org. Now there you will find also information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. khoifm.org.
You've been listening to Local Talk on Community Radio, where we've explored the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Paul Wearson and I, Susan Franzen, have been your hosts for today. Other voices you heard were Dennis Hart, Kay Munson, Patience Luth, and Mark Edwards. Local Talk was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was In the Good Old Summertime by Trubal Acapella Barbershop Quartet.
And Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. And if you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or you can contact us through our website, khoyfm.org. That's also what you need to know, and contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Right on that website, just look for the yellow donate button.
If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening, and
see you again on the radio.
KHOI is sponsored in part by Ames Electric Services, reminding you to lower your electric demand between 5 and 8 p.m. during the summer heat. Help keep electricity in Ames affordable by lowering your thermostat, closing your drapes, and running appliances in the early morning or later at night.